Welcome to the Bob Siegel Show. We're in the midst of a series on evidence for the existence of some kind of God. If you've missed the previous episodes, I did make a rational case that some kind of creator exists. And so, continuing again with my rhetorical skeptic friend based on many, many, many people I've talked to over the years, all these are comments I have heard in person. Bob, all this does is make an argument for some kind of God. That doesn't mean he's the God of the Bible. Well, a good case can be made for the biblical God, my friend, but only after we establish God's nature. When doing so, we will conclude that God, whoever or whatever he is loving and good. Now you're thinking, loving and good, didn't you leap to that conclusion rather hastily? Well, here the conscience helps us again. We learn about an artist from his artwork. Does it not make sense that creation would tell us a few things about God? How can we explain any noble human qualities apart from the source of life? Now, at this point, somebody might say, well, supposing the creator is both good and evil. After all, people are both good and evil. Is this not the most likely possibility? Well, my friends, there is no principle beyond God. Once again, we already established the relationship between morality and personality. Good and evil are not entities in themselves. They are choices and thoughts. It makes no sense to say that God would choose evil and choose good at the same time. The inward awareness of accountability tells you that God expects people to live a certain way. This revelation is based upon a divine decision. To say that God is also evil is to make God undecided in the standards he wants to establish. This would invalidate any reason to hold men and women accountable. Why would God create a conscience that condemns murder if he himself were uncertain how he feels about murder? It would be a contradiction for God to say that evil was occasionally preferable or justified. If such were the case, evil would not be evil. Evil would be an opinion. Your conscience points to an awareness of God's opinion regarding standards. And I understand opinion is an inadequate word when we're talking about God, but such an opinion, I mean, is ultimate reality. As our creator, he holds the sole authority to establish such ideas, and he has these ideas because it's just the way he is. He is good. He hates evil. It's part of his nature. So you're asking, but if morality was established by God, could I not disagree with his establishment? Well, once again, that question is irrelevant. I mentioned this last time. It's irrelevant because you were created in such a way that you do not disagree. You disobey, but you do not disagree. We all disobey, but we do not disagree. In fact, as I've said before, the fact that we're so disobedient, the fact that we don't pay much attention to our conscience is one of the greatest arguments that we as human beings did not invent the conscience. If we were going to invent the conscience, we'd invent a set of ethics that we like better, that we live up to better. We'd invent a set of ethics and say, hey, it's great to be selfish. It's great to look out for number one. But is this really goodness? Yes, because the author of life says so. There can never be a more final decision. Remember, there was a time when only God, with his personality and the morals embedded in his personality, existed. Since he created everything, it is impossible to find a legitimate basis with which to challenge him. This is Bob Siegel making the obvious obvious.
Believe it or not, Bob Siegel is aware that there may be one or two people who disagree with his opinions. To offer your own comments on the topic at hand, or to challenge Bob with a thought-provoking question, feel free to contact Bob on Facebook or questions@bobsiegel.net.
We go back to something I said very early on in the discussion when I was looking at the possibilities for the universe. One of them, theory C, some kind of creator or creators. Now, again, as a Christian, I'm a monotheist. I do believe in the Trinity, but I believe the Trinity, the persons of the Trinity, make up one God. There are discussions about that that I've done on previous shows. However, when we're discussing rational philosophy, we need to be hypothetical because we can be talking to somebody who is not a Christian, who has not yet made that assumption. So at this point in the discussion, a very legitimate question comes up. Okay, there's an argument for some kind of creator, but could that not just as easily be creators in the plural? In fact, Bob, you talk about God being good. Could there also be another God who happens to be evil? Well, let me respond to that. A co-creator is an unlikely possibility. In such a case, neither being will have the exclusive claim to authentic judgment. If a co-creator decides that evil is permissible, people, as products of two divinities, will find themselves in a state of moral neutrality. This, once again, leads to relative rules and a confusing life. We would also conclude that an evil God is not really evil. He is instead a timeless being who chose a different code of ethics. As one of two eternal entities, his decision goes unchallenged. Since the good God is an equal, not a superior, even he must remain silent. Both gods will therefore confess a difference of viewpoint. At the first appeal to common ground, they are acknowledging principles of a higher order than them. Since that cannot be, the gods would be forced to concede a stalemate. There is no hope, then, for the correct standards. Good will never prevail. On what basis would the moral God communicate to his creatures that good should prevail unless he wanted to lie? And if he lied, he would not be good himself. What would be the final result? Everlasting, frustrating chaos, which forces us to abandon our earlier conclusion that life had meaning. For reasons already mentioned, this is not an option. Now, there is, of course, another obvious question to ask. For what possible reason would a good and evil God collaborate in creation? A God who is truly good will never cooperate with evil. In the final analysis, the only sensible explanation for your conscience is one God who made an unquestionable decision. We do not know why his nature desired such a choice. Okay, but Bob, even if we throw out the evil God, does that mean there's only one righteous, eternal creator? Couldn't there be several good gods? Well, my friend, that's certainly a fair question. However, it would not wash. Two eternal beings agreeing on purpose and morality would again have to appeal to higher principles, and higher principles, once again, cannot exist apart from personality. One God need not appeal to anything. All right, but Bob, why assume that God is eternal? Couldn't a finite God have created a finite universe? Yes, possibly, but even if our God is not infinite, an eternal creator would still be out there somewhere. We established earlier that an eternal personality must exist. Once establishing an eternal God, we recognize the possibility that he just created us directly. In fact, it becomes highly questionable why he would use a middleman. Nevertheless, to maintain an open mind, we will simply conclude at this point in the discussion that with or without a finite God, the infinite God exists. All right, then, Bob, could our hypothetical finite creator be evil? Could he be the evil one? Well, because the eternal God will not act contrary to his goodness, we assume that the finite God, if he exists, was created himself to be loving and good. Ah, but Bob, could not the finite God have fallen into evil choices just as men and women did? Yes, potentially, but the infinite God, because of his nature, would not let such a being hold his creation accountable to standards he himself doesn't even follow, because that would not be fair to the third party. Our moral imperfection can only be measured against the standard of moral perfection. In summary, my friends, a finite creator, by contrast to the infinite creator, is not truly God. And our ultimate source of life, therefore, is the eternal God. Up to now, I have been defending the existence from rational philosophy of some kind of God, and we have established that this is a loving God. Once we've established God as loving, you would be amazed how quickly we can go from the God of the universe being a loving God to the God of the universe being one and the same as the God who reveals himself in the Bible. And let me tell you why. Because, my friends, the establishment of a loving God supplies many additional conclusions. There are things a loving God would do. There are things a loving God would not do. We can now test different religions to see if they are indeed talking about a loving God. Now, I'm going to define religion as an alleged truth about our existence revealed from some type of higher order. These various belief systems should be compared to the following expectations. First of all, if the Creator is loving, the Creator will reveal himself to people. Now, I'm frequently amazed at the typical assumption that God would be doing something out of the ordinary by speaking with his own creation. Certainly, God is capable of communication. Otherwise, we would not be capable of communication. Is it conceivable that a moral, loving God would withhold such contact? Would it not be cruel for him to create us for a reason and then not let us in on the secret? A search for meaning apart from some type of religion leads only to the dead end of despair. A loving God would not delight in such emptiness. If meaning and value are found only in the Creator, he would be most cold and most cruel not to share this meaning and value. Can you just imagine this? God says, I created you for a purpose. You've been living this time on earth. You've been going through this trek of existence. I created you. I know why I created you. But I'm not going to tell you. I'm just going to mess with your head, leave you by yourself, leave you on your own to figure it out. No, my friends, that would not be a loving God. That would be a cruel God. But we've already established that God is loving. We must conclude then that a loving God reveals himself. Good. So, next question. This will deal with the specifics of his revelation. If he's going to reveal himself, if he's going to speak, what exactly would we expect him to say? What kinds of things about our life would we expect him to reveal? Now, naturally, when I say expectation, we can't limit ourselves. We can't place limitations on God's mode or style. We should rid ourselves of ultimatums. Well, God, if you have something to say to me, then you should contact me at exactly 2 a.m. I'll be asleep, but you wake me up, and I want you to show up in my living room. And remember that movie back in the 70s called Oh, God? I want you to show up, and I want you to look just like George Burns, even though George Burns is dead. And if you do that, God, then I'll know it's you. All right, my friends, is God obligated to accommodate our peculiar expectations? Of course not. God can communicate any way he chooses. It may be with an audible voice, but he can also use dreams, visions, prophets, feelings, all of the above, none of the above. Remember, we are not inventing the rules. Yes, we would expect him to speak, but he speaks the way he wants. He speaks the way he chooses. Now, this next one is key. Well, they're all key. Okay, they're all key. But this next one is really key. Maybe because it comes next. Well, the order is important here. We would also assume that if the Creator is revealing himself to people in the present, he has always been revealing himself to people in the past. Why do I say that? Because that, too, would be the only consistent act of love. I'm quite suspicious of the lone prophet who claims to be the first person to ever encounter God. That kind of partiality would be quite unfair to the billions upon billions upon billions who have been around since the beginning of time and measured history. With all due respect to divine activity, we have just eliminated most religions from consideration. Let me say that again. We have just eliminated most religions for consideration. Why? Because we're disregarding all new ones. And new ones pop up all the time. Only ancient religions are still in the running, provided they give a claim of revelation as far back as human history can be traced. But of course, there must be more than a claim. It makes sense that people would keep records of such divine activity. the God of the universe is coming down to earth, revealing himself to the world, and there's no record of it? No, my friends, God's intervention generation after generation can hardly escape notice because it would have influenced history in dramatic and powerful and profound ways. A collection of 39 ancient manuscripts known as the Old Testament makes exactly this claim. Judaism, Christianity, and Islam all adhere to the Old Testament. They claim they do. The scriptures of Hinduism and Native American traditions are examples, although not exclusive examples, of alternate divine claims that also point to antiquity. Yeah, but Bob, if God is willing to speak with everyone, why are there so many different religions? Do they each present the truth in a different fashion? If so, Jesus would not be the only way. Well, my friend, now we are moving into a question of consistency, and it would help to start with the teaching of an ancient philosopher. I refer to Aristotle often in my talks, most specifically his law of non-contradiction. This law, foundational to philosophy, states that two given truth claims must not contradict. If they do, at least one of them is wrong, and possibly they are both wrong. We accept this idea without hesitation in every facet of life. Every facet of life except Christianity, that is. This should be simple. This should not be rocket science. But people act like it is when discussing religion. Why? Because people are usually afraid to test religions out of fear that they will be showing intolerance or be branded as closed-minded. It should be noted that one can respect freedom of religion without assuming that all religions are equally valid, because those conclusions are intellectually dishonest. My friend, you may believe whatever you want. You may believe in a different religion than Christianity. You believe whatever religion you want. We live in a free country. You may not be religious at all. You may be an agnostic. You may be an atheist. That's fine. We're talking here about testing what is in fact true, not what we should be allowed legally to believe, or what we should just be allowed to believe socially to get along. While lecturing a number of years ago at the University of Minnesota, the noted Christian apologist Cliff Connectley was confronted by a student who claimed that all religions were basically the same. Cliff responded with a piercing analogy. He said, "If I were to assume that all Chinese people were the same, it would mean one of two things. Either I'm a bigot, or I have not taken the time to get to know Chinese people. The same is true of religious assumptions." Yes, my friends, even when admitting that religions do in fact teach opposite theologies, many stubbornly grasp to the idea that somehow every one of them came from the same God. Why? Why is it so easy to envision a creator who unveils contradictory information? Why must a belief in God be divorced from our God-given ability to think? Paradoxically, people are not afraid to put Christianity through the ringer. Its claims are confronted all the time. Once, while doing an open forum at Fresno City College, I was asked about Mormonism. Now, I've said often on this show, I respect Mormons as people, and politically, they've been great allies. They hold the same conservative values, at least many of them, most of them. But anyway, here we're talking about theology, what Mormons teach as a religion. And I was asked about Mormonism. I mentioned that they claim to go by the Bible, yet teach polytheism, which completely contradicts the Bible. Isaiah 43 is one of many places which make it abundantly clear there is only one God. Well, a young lady raised her hand in undergrad. She says, "What right do you have to stand here and scrutinize somebody else's religion?" I didn't let her get away with this. I said, "Hold on. For the last 2 hours, you specifically, you and your friends have been doing nothing but scrutinizing my religion. Doesn't the Bible contradict itself? How do you know Jesus rose from the dead? Why would a loving God send people to hell?" You went on and on and on. You asked all kinds of questions, all kinds of challenging questions, and this has not bothered me. I've actually enjoyed it because I think it's very appropriate. We are in an institution of higher learning. We're in the free speech area of a college campus. You should challenge me. You should challenge anyone who makes a truth claim. But it works both ways. Make no mistake. I will ask these exact same questions of other religions. You should have seen her, my friends. She actually nodded because her double standard became obvious. It's interesting how everybody just assumes Christianity is fair game, and when the tables are turned, they don't like it. But to her credit, she recognized that what I was saying was true. Her earlier skeptical questions confirmed an honest, inward conviction that all beliefs, even religious ones, must be examined. We have to test whether they contradict themselves. We have to test whether they contradict each other. There isn't time right now to give every major religion its rightful day in court, but a few brief examples will at least illustrate the points. Hindus believe in pantheism. I've talked about pantheism on previous shows, so again, it's the difference between God creating the universe or the universe itself just being God. We've already established that God is a thinking, feeling personality, so that one, ancient as it is, does not conform with a loving God, because they're talking actually there about an impersonal universe. There are also contradictions between religions which accept the Bible. I mentioned already Christianity, Judaism, and Islam all claim to go by the Old Testament. The Jews don't call it the Old Testament. The Muslims don't call it the Old Testament. The Christians do. But it's the same collection, the same volume that they're talking about. Islam claims that in addition to the Quran, both the Old and New Testament are the Word of God. Jesus is described in the Quran as a holy prophet, but not an incarnation of God himself. In fact, they make it very clear that Jesus is not God. Well, the test for a prophet in the Old Testament is that he must be accurate in everything he teaches. Jesus taught that he was God. We read about that in the New Testament. Muslims claim to go by that too. If Jesus was lying, he was not a prophet. But Islam claims he was a prophet. Well, if Jesus was telling the truth, then he is God because he claimed to be God. But Islam claims he wasn't God. Either way, we have a rather serious contradiction. Judaism now, and again, I come out of Judaism, so if you're going to call me anti-Semitic right now because I'm about to critique Judaism, think again. I am Jewish myself, a Jewish Christian, but Jewish. Anyway, Judaism teaches that the old covenant will be changed after the Messiah comes. Jeremiah chapter 31 makes that very clear. Well, in the 9th chapter of Daniel, Daniel actually computes the time when the Messiah is going to come by measuring the amount in Hebrew years of 30 days each. He starts with the return of the Jews from Persian rule when King Artaxerxes freed the Jewish slaves, and ends up with Messiah's arrival. I have seen that date calculated and converted to the Julian calendar. Only one potential Messiah rode into Jerusalem that day, the day that's often referred to as Palm Sunday. That was Jesus of Nazareth who rode in. If he was the Messiah, then Judaism's new covenant, which we call Christianity, is now in force, because Christianity just means followers of the Messiah. But if he wasn't the Messiah, then Daniel was a false prophet. Well, my friends, does Judaism consider Daniel to be a false prophet, Orthodox Judaism? Of course not. Judaism considers Daniel to be a true prophet. We have found the contradiction with Judaism as well. I must be making myself very unpopular right now. Please understand, I do respect the many Muslims, Hindus, Jews, Mormons, Universalists, and others. I have met many people from many different religions, and I have found them to be very honest and dedicated people. However, this does not keep me from examining their claims. So you're thinking, all right, Bob, but is Christianity any more consistent? It seems there are many contradictions to the Bible. That's a very good question, my friend, an excellent question, and I will tackle that one next week on The Bob Siegel Show.
The Bob Siegel Show is sponsored in part by the Law Offices of Matthew Simone.